From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. Tonight's top worry: if something happens to your apartment and you need to, like, stay in a hotel and pay for it, that would be crazy, right? Art Palpitations has more.
That would be crazy, Tammy, but you got surprisingly affordable renter's insurance through GEICO, so it could be covered, giving you peace of mind.
Aww, I love a story that ends well.
Next up, love stories. Are they all they're cracked up to be?
It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.
Save big money on everything at Menards. Take control of your outdoor space with Roundup, Weed, and Grass Killer. The Pump and Go container is ready and easy to use. With the Pump and Go sprayer, you don't need to mix your own liquid, and you get up to 10 minutes of continuous spray. Save big on Roundup, Weed, and Grass Killer. Plus, check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Welcome back to the case of Brandi Peltz. In our last episode, we mentioned The Passerby, which was a book written about the events of Brandi's death. Names have been fictionalized, but the author insists that the information contained inside is true. The author, a man named Thomas Ray Crowell, investigated this case when he moved to the small town of Argus, where the murder occurred. Because we are lacking in official reports, and so many people connected to this case have since passed away, this book is our only source of those accounts. However, a lot of this information would be considered hearsay, and the author has been known to fictionalize details. In light of that, we would like to preface that this resource is being used to build theories and open avenues of investigation for later. It is not being treated as firsthand evidence against any of these people. I have had conversations with the book's publicist, who investigated with Crowell, in order to ensure that the accounts included in this episode are written as she remembers them. As a bit of background, The Passerby details a real 2-year investigation in which real people were interviewed and had the chance to tell their story. Following the release of the book, a lot of controversy was stirred up as people in Argus gained access to their neighbors' unfiltered thoughts and theories about the crime. Many claim the book is bogus, while others are adamant about its truthfulness. So, once again, treat this information with some degree of skepticism, and keep in mind that we will be using the falsified names that he created. While the book is named after the author's main suspect, we believe that it is important to investigate every suspect and recount the information we've learned in detail. As such, this episode will cover 3 other suspicious individuals, and our next episode will cover the passerby and accounts of Brandi's mother's behavior. In doing so, we hope to make the information in the book more accessible and share with the world some theories that would otherwise dissipate.
Following Brandi's tragic death, rumors quickly spread throughout the town. There were whispers of a drug-addled Englishman, the mother's jilted lover, or even Brandi's father himself. Perhaps the most sensationalized rumor we uncovered was that the local reverend had been responsible. This was one of the first leads Crowell pursued when he started his investigation of the town's residents. For clarification, there are 2 reverends referenced in the Peltz case: Reverend Hummock, who was active during the time of Brandi's death, and a previous reverend named Reverend Storm. According to the word buzzing about, the reverend was personally involved with Roxy, which was odd for a man of the church to be so close to the kind of woman the town perceived her as. This detail is interesting because Roxy was allegedly also involved with the man known as Mitch Wiersma in The Passerby, who we also will touch on later. Many say that if the Reverend was having some kind of relationship with Roxy, this would put him in a difficult moral situation considering his position as a Baptist minister, but also in personal peril as he was married to a woman the book calls Helen. Those moral contradictions and several comments he's believed to have made is why he has landed himself on the suspect list for others looking at the case. But are his supposed actions really enough to label him as a credible suspect when looking at the details? The Peltz family had always had connections to the church and even being on the board of directors despite the reputation Roxy had amongst the community. Their first connection was through Reverend Storm when his wife would babysit Brandy when she was younger. Though the couple eventually moved away and made way for Reverend Hummock to enter their lives instead. The day of the murder, the Reverend was not in town but was out Christmas shopping for his family. While he was out, his wife, Helen, was at home with the flu, meaning that she could confirm that he was not in town that day to be near the Peltz home. At first, the Reverend said he was shopping at Westbound, but Helen seemed to remind him that he was in Ashbrook. Some may pull this detail as trying to create a false alibi or an attempt to distance himself from the crime. Though it is very common for someone to only estimate their location or instead use a place somewhere nearby they are familiar with. The Reverend's connection doesn't end here, as he continued to be active within the Peltz family after the case. When the funeral for Brandy had come, the Reverend was there as well. He was quoted in the book saying that some good will come of this. And that odd statement became another detail people used to flag him as a suspect. Most people wouldn't equate the death of a young girl with coming fortune, but his background in the church could justify this statement if he were a follower that believed in predestination or God's plan. The more things happened at the funeral involving Hummock that continued to flag him as a suspect. While talking to people at the funeral, he reminded Roxy not to pick up Brandy's body from the casket due to bruising Brandy had sustained on her neck. This comment had confused the author because why would he know the state of the body? It was then stated that Roxy had told the Reverend several details from the autopsy on Brandy and that his comments about the bruises were simply a reminder to Roxy to take care of the body. The author then continues on with his questioning and asks the Reverend if he was attracted to Roxy, and the Reverend replies with a negative. Though this contradicts a later statement as the story continues. 2 to 3 weeks after the murder, the Peltz family moved in with the Reverend into the parsonage with him and his wife. As anyone can imagine, this transition was difficult for them and it had shown, especially in Roxy's actions. While they were living with the Reverend, the book had stated that Roxy tried to take her own life with a butcher's knife. Though, after about a month of living with the Hummocks, Roxy and the others moved out on a claim that the Reverend was attracted to her. The Reverend recalls this sudden distancing and says that he may have ministered her incorrectly in his youth. The Reverend's connection to the family had sparked a theory in the author's mind. The author explains that maybe the Reverend was seen exchanging niceties with the family, like kissing Roxy on the cheek, and someone was peeping from the vacant house across the street. He then continues to explain that the peeper may have gotten jealous and enraged with the family. The Reverend denies that he would have given Roxy that kind of attention due to his position in the church. The Reverend's wife had something to say about a suspect when questioned. Her first thought was that she had no idea who may have done it, but later on she changed her tune to the Englishman as a suspect who will be explained later. As the case progressed forward, Hummock was being questioned about Reverend Storm, but as the questioning kept going, Emily Storm implied an affair between Hummock and Roxy, which the Reverend once again denied. As time went on, Hummock advised Roxy to not speak with the sheriff to stop scrutiny against her reputation. All of this even after their distancing, though Roxy was much closer to another man who may have had more to do with the case.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
A local mechanic of some sort, whose fictional name was Hugh Dixon, allegedly saw a car in the driveway the day of Brandy's death. It was a green Oldsmobile Cutlass, and he particularly noted the souped-up fenders. He thought it was strange because he knew the father from high school and he wasn't interested in cars like that. Due to his work schedule, he estimated it was sometime between noon and 1 o'clock that he saw the car, but he couldn't give any other details. When he found out that the Peltz's daughter had been murdered, he reported the suspicious vehicle to the sheriff's department, but no one ever came to question him about it. He thought that was the end of it because the police did not investigate and he hadn't seen the car since the incident. That was until 5 years later, when he spotted the same Oldsmobile parked at the fire station. Thinking he had a lead, he drove all over town trying to find a police officer to explain it to. He found someone on patrol, luckily the same man he talked to around the time of the initial incident, and told him what he had seen. However, the officer was reluctant to pursue it. Nevertheless, Hugh stopped by the station the next day to check in and was informed that Mitch Wiersma, that's his book name, was the owner. It had been his for years, the officer said, something Hugh supported with his own memory that he had sold him a replacement engine for a Cutlass 5 or 6 years earlier. This set off a light bulb for the author and would-be investigator. Wiersma was the name of the current sheriff, wasn't it? As it turns out, Mitch was his nephew. Keep in mind all of this happened from 1985 to 1991, so it's been at least 20 years since then in the book's timeline. The author reasons that there's no way the old car is still around, and Hugh confides in the author that the Oldsmobile has since been hauled away and scrapped. He saw it with his own eyes, but the guilt and remorse he felt from seeing the car that day had never faded. The story of the Cutlass led him to the family of the very man that investigated the car, Officer Spencer Logan and his son, Tim. Tim said he remembered Hugh coming to Dad's house the day of the murder because he and his brother were eavesdropping around the corner. Hugh said he saw a car, the Cutlass, earlier in the day, and Dad said that he'd pass it along. Then, after Hugh had left, the boys heard him tell their mother that the vehicle belongs to someone in the fire department. Years later, Tim remembered the conversation and convinced a friend, whose brother was a firefighter, to get into the personnel records. The roster he was given was from the mid-1980s. But he recognized almost no one except for Mitch. Please note that this is 4 degrees of separation from the source, and therefore somewhat unreliable. Nevertheless, it served as additional proof for the author that Mitch was involved. Later on, the author dropped by the home of the Wiersmas searching for Mitch. He met with the sheriff's ex-wife, who remembered the Cutlass because it was originally her car, and it was her father who painted it green. She commented that Mitch was doing the bodywork now, and she was glad he never finished it, because she didn't want to be seen in it. She confirms that her nephew ended up taking the car to the junkyard himself, but that she doesn't know where or when. Then, as a passing comment before they left, she accused Mitch of being a violent man. Now, Mitch had been out of state for a while. Hugh says he's on dope. He used to be dealing, but now he's doing it himself. Which leads us to quite the inflammatory statement. The officers were using, too. Now, we've done our due diligence and done background checks on the real identities of both Mitch and the police officers we could find, and we found no documented criminal history. This neither proves nor disproves the drug allegations, but seeing as we have no real proof, we do not want to lean on this information too heavily. The author states that Mitch appeared to have numerous people attempting to cover for him or keep him out of the focus of this investigation, perhaps due to his connection with the sheriff. There was this feeling that the family name had to be protected. Given this, the author presumes that Mitch wouldn't talk about what he knew because he was an ex-cop in a family of cops, so there is no first-hand account from him. Still, his theory is that Mitch was not directly responsible for the crime. The reason why his Oldsmobile was seen in the driveway was because he drove Roxy there from work around lunchtime, waited there until she was done checking up on her daughter, and then returned to work afterwards. This timeline is consistent with the newspaper clipping we found in which the manager confirms Roxy leaving during her lunch. However, her boss did not include who the driver was. This theory holds water but leaves us with a couple questions. How close were Mitch and Roxy? Did she often have him drive her places? Was it her coworker that drove her back home later in the day after the fire had been reported? More proof is needed to be sure if his involvement was considerate or something more sinister. Unfortunately, Roxy was adamant about not talking to the author, so we have no way of confirming. Now, I had the opportunity to interview the author's fellow investigator and publicist. While the author believed that the passerby had perpetrated that horrible act and Mitch was simply in the area, she has some different thoughts. She believes that the passerby assaulted Brandy, but did so post-mortem, after Mitch had killed her. This is due to conflicting accounts of whether or not Roxy visited during her lunch hour, and testimony from a self-proclaimed psychic. There isn't a lot of evidence to prove this theory, so it is wildly inconceivable. The chances of there being two violently deviant men in this town who visited the same home to assault the same little girl are very small. It would take an orchestrated act, not a coincidence like she claims, and there is no proof of any collusion between the two. We have no motive, but let's assume Mitch had killed Brandy and placed her in the bathtub. That means the passerby would then walk in, remove her from the tub, assault her, and then put her back. It is a stretch. There are a lot of mysteries in this case, but I don't think they can be solved with wild theories.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Throughout the book, many of the people in Argus cast blame towards a mysterious Englishman named Peter Lacey, who was allegedly a drug addict. He was dating a woman that was allegedly a friend of Roxy's named Tammy in the book, who the author was unfortunately able to contact. It was through investigating this lead that the author was called by a woman who claimed to be friends with one of the Englishmen, named Roger Lawford. Apparently, there were actually two Englishmen in Argus at the time, both of whom were interested in riding motorcycles. She didn't think Roger could have murdered Brandy because she didn't know the family and wasn't in the States when she was killed. Roger only came back to Argus around 1 year later, after Brandy had already passed. She reveals that originally Roger and his friend, Willie, both came to buy collectible motorcycles and ship them back to the United Kingdom because they knew about the variation of bikes in the American countryside via an enthusiast that visited a cycle show in London. Even the author mentioned that seemed like an implausible reason to be in the country, but the woman insisted that this is what happened. Roger led plenty of Englishmen that came and went, but apparently the locals weren't friendly to him at all, aside from Hugh, who didn't believe that Roger had anything to do with it. After poking around the English side of things, Roger's friend Willie called the author to clear the air. The woman who claimed to know Roger originally had given him the number to call. He said he went to the funeral of Roger after he died in a motorcycle accident, as proof that the two were close. He seemingly wasn't sure if Roger was even in the country at the time of Brandy's death, and commented that it sounded convenient that the people of Argus were trying to pin it on someone out of the country, because neither he nor Roger knew the family. Reverend Hummock told Ray he knew the other British man, Peter Lacey. He confirmed that Lacey lived with Tammy in the trailer park. They were married only a few months before the murder, and the marriage lasted a short time, only around 4 months before he went back to England. Apparently, Tammy was buying out ads to be in the newspaper saying she was looking for a Christian husband, which was how she met Lacey. Since they had only been dating for a short time at that point, it was difficult for them to find a preacher to marry them. In the end, Hummock ended up marrying them together. Hummock also claims that Tammy told Roxy that she believes Lacey has something to do with Brandy's death. Later, Roxy also said that she didn't believe the Englishmen were interviewed well enough, but Hummock never told the police what he had heard. In the next section of the book, the author ends up tracking down Tammy's half-sister in order to speak more on the dynamic within the couple. She claims that Lacey was abusive. He threw his stepson against the kitchen wall and put out cigarettes on the kids. He was also a monster in her eyes. To make matters worse, she also got an obscene phone call from someone claiming to have killed Brandy, during which the caller said they wouldn't hesitate to kill her if word got out about the call. They had a British accent, leading her to believe Lacey was the one on the other end. Despite all the rumors circulating, all of this information was fresh for the author, leading him to wonder why these facts remained hidden.
She claimed it was because he passed lie detector tests, so the country sheriffs let him off the hook, allowing him to return to England. From what was written, we can gather that she was critical of the investigating officers, Hummock and Lacey. She thought Hummock was strange, if not suspicious, and accused Lacey of being a crazy drug addict. From here, multiple pages are dedicated to stories of erratic behavior that can be summed up as cheating and wanting to buy a handgun out of nowhere. Up until now, the investigation had pointed Lacey in a very bad light, but that isn't the only side of it. For instance, Lacey's sister called for a short while to clear the air. While her brother didn't want to talk, she clarified that a motorcycle accident left him disabled. She also didn't believe he would ever harm someone. Then a family friend reportedly caught the Lacey residence on the day of Brandy's death, and when Lacey answered, he was crying about the tragic loss. Word traveled fast, because it was only 3:39 p.m. Later, his wife said that Lacey said we went to a neighboring town for a job interview, but also reportedly told Roxy that she believed Lacey had murdered Brandy. These two senses are incongruous. How could Lacey have perpetrated the crime if he had a clear alibi? In light of this, the author left to investigate that alibi further. The family that owned the restaurant Lacey allegedly visited cooperated with the author. The owner said he dressed nicely and was in town all day to interview for the position of a cook. After his wife heard rumors of Lacey's involvement in the recent death, he told the detectives in charge of Brandy's case, but allegedly there was no follow-up. It is unfortunate that law enforcement did not verify it publicly, but according to the publicist, the alibi is credible and may even be part of the reason why Lacey was allowed to leave the country. So if two suspects having alibis and a third having a solid connection to Roxy, the author moved on to the main suspect and the subject of our next episode.
Throughout the years, people have not given up on Brandy, and in an effort to contribute to that, we will strive to make sure her voice is heard. By retracing the steps others have taken and spreading their stories, we hope to make this case more accessible to others who may be able to offer their assistance. So, once again, if you have any information relating to this case, you can reach us at underestimatedtips@gmail.com. Underestimated Brandy Peltz was researched, written, and produced by Gracie, Lexi, and Jacob. Intro music by Haley, all other music by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Jacob. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community School's Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping to fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.